I just want to pause for a moment to thank NTT Data, who sponsored us at Money 2020. NTT Data Services is a global business innovator, partnering with clients to simplify the modern complexities of business and technology, delivering the insight, solutions, and outcomes that matter most. Basically, they get stuff done. Learn more at nttdataservices.com.
You need to do one thing really, really well. You need to find your niche. What are you going to uniquely add value on?
We rightly celebrate the struggles of startups and their brave founders, but it can be tough working in a bigger company too, where powerful corporate antibodies seek and destroy new ideas that don't conform to the conventional culture. But some leaders battle the status quo inside their own companies to innovate and drive change. These are the serial entrepreneurs, and this is their story.
So I'm Megan Kaywood, and I'm the Chief Platform Officer at Starling Bank. My background is in fintech out of San Francisco, previously leading development at Intuit and Xero, which are two of the world's largest financial technology companies. So I was really excited to be able to move over to the UK and bring that experience into Starling Bank, one of the now leading challenger banks in the UK.
Right. So now you're almost more of an entrepreneur, right? Mm-hmm. An early stage company.
Yeah, I was employee number 30, I think. So right, just kind of not 25, which is what I'd hoped for, but close.
But you've worked for larger companies. You mentioned mm-hmm. Intuit and Xero, fairly, maybe in the middle of that, right?
Yeah.
I think if you look back at the history of fintech, you'd have Intuit as a very early stage in the mid-90s and mm-hmm. Xero maybe about 10 years ago, something mm-hmm. like that.
Yep, about 10 years ago. And it was, I want to say it was around only 500 people when I joined there and around 1,000 when I left. So yeah, they're even more than that now. So they're growing quite a bit as well.
Yeah. So take us back even further. Tell us about your education and your background and how did you even get into this business?
Definitely. So I actually started out with a very strong interest in psychology. But what part of drove me to that is I come from a background of lawyers and they all really wanted me to go into law in my family. And so psychology was one of the four preferred social sciences as a prerequisite for going into law school. So I was like, oh, don't worry, Grandpa, this will definitely pave my way for law school, even though I had no interest in law school. So I was planning, though, eventually to get my PhD in cognitive science. So doing a bunch of research there. But what happened was a good friend of mine was very entrepreneurial, and he had this idea to start an entrepreneurs club at our university, the first ever. And we were going to use the club's budget as capital to start an LLC, a limited liability corporation. We were going to be a closed private club. So it was just a cross-functional team, about six of us, developer, designer, who were going to just build something really cool and outsource it to some developers in China because they decided abroad in Shanghai. It was going to be great. Anyway, so it turns out lots of red tape with clubs' budgets at universities. So didn't quite go as smoothly as we'd hoped.
And what university was this?
That was at Pepperdine. So that's my alma mater. So later I did a bunch of research.
That's a horrible campus, right?
I know.
Overlooking the Pacific Ocean.
Yeah, Malibu, you know, such a rough place to have to study, but someone had to do it. So here I am. but yeah, it made me fall in love with starting companies and the kind of entrepreneurial path. So I was then doing research at Stanford when I decided instead I would just kind of pivot and go into tech. And here I am today.
So what was your first kind of real job then coming out of college?
I started at Intuit as a product manager, but it was in a rotational development program, which means that you can do 4 6-month rotations from product management to UX to even software development if you didn't have a background there. And I thought that would be great because coming from cognitive science, that doesn't really mean that any of my research would necessarily lend itself to that area. So I really kind of wanted the exposure. But what I found is that I started in product management. I loved it. And I just kept doing it, even though marketing was always a huge aspect of that role as well. But I started it into it where they were really just beginning to move into agile and where we were just working in these small cross-functional teams. We just sat at a table with our computers side by side. We'd go out and do customer research together. And it was a really exciting time to join the company. So I stayed within product management and then went into global eventually, leading expansion to the UK, which is ultimately how I ended up leading Xero's global product and then deciding I really wanted to focus on the UK because it's such a great hub for fintech in terms of the regulatory environment, in terms of venture capital. And so I ultimately decided there would be no better place to be. And I originally saw myself as starting my own company. And then I met Ann Bowden. And then I was like, well, I don't think I can do as well as she's doing because now I realize that if you're going to be innovating anywhere, it's in banking. So I joined Starling with Ann.
So part of the inspiration for joining Starling was because of Anne.
Definitely. Well, so I had an idea for a fintech company that I wanted to start. But when I met Anne, what she really illuminated for me is that fintechs right now are just kind of innovating at the edge. We haven't seen the same type of transformation within financial services and banking that we have seen every other area of technology. And part of that was because until the last few years, no one could get a banking license. So at the end of the day, all these fintechs were still relying on these banks, these really old institutions for funds flows. At the end of the day, it all went back to banks. No one was innovating really there at the core. So now, given the new regulation, given the new place in the market, given everything that happened since the financial crisis, it was right place, right time to really start innovating on the thing that the hub that all fintechs were really relied on at the end of the day.
So let's talk about your role as an entrepreneur in all these companies. You've worked for pretty innovative companies. I mean, did you ever run into a bad situation or a bad boss that kind of didn't get it? That, you know, some people listening to this are, you know, really frustrated that they're surrounded by what we like to call the business prevention department.
Yeah.
Did you ever have that?
I didn't necessarily have that. But what I did find is that I had great macro manager bosses, but one of the teams, the second team I worked with at Intuit, had this tension where a number of product managers had kind of cycled through this team in rapid succession, which wasn't a great sign. They would go in and they'd leave for emergency medical reasons. And I was like, ooh. But really what happened when we dug into it, what we realized is that management was trying to create incentives for people to work on the highest priority thing, right? Like you do. And so for the engineers, that meant reducing tech debt. And then they made the incentives for product managers, new feature releases. And they were at complete odds with each other. And so there would inevitably be this tension as to what people wanted to work on. So that was from an entrepreneur perspective on how do we get things done and move quickly, something that we had to reconcile that we need to be aligned on what we need to work on and what order and figuring out how we could kind of get that shared vision of what we needed and wanted to do.
So what lessons did you have early on to figure out how to negotiate that? And I think everyone runs into that, right? You have these conflicting priorities in the workplace.
Yeah.
And particularly in your career, you tend to listen to, your boss that tells you go do this, but yet you've got these other conflicts. What lessons did you learn on how to reconcile all that and figure out the right path forward?
I'll say that I was very fortunate to start my career into it because when I started in the program, they had about 6 weeks of training on the best-in-class agile methodologies. Lean Startup book, the principles that are taught there, I almost forgot. It's a great book. I would highly recommend it. Kind of looking through all of these new ways that we can collaborate and kind of push innovation. And so they did this training to create what they called Innovation Catalyst. So then when they sent us out in the company, it was very much with the vision of we're working in a style that doesn't work given the advancements in technology. The waterfall style just isn't going to help us to keep pace with change. And they were very much aware that they had to disrupt themselves as a 30-year-old company if they wanted to compete with startups. And that their existing practices, their existing methodology, their existing products even wouldn't be what took them to the next stage in the future if they wanted to stay competitive and relevant. So when I started my first role, I actually had this boss who basically said, one thing that you're being measured on is that you create a winning strategy that has consensus from the shareholder for mobile TurboTax, if you've heard of the product. So I was in charge of mobile. But what I found when I started that role, the challenge was that people have been working in Waterfall and the engineers had this term that they use called code monkeys. So they felt like they just kind of got handed the thing that they had to build out to a T. So I'd just been gone through this whole 6 weeks of training. So when I came and I was like, that's not how we're going to do it. We're going to figure out what we need to build together. We're going to decide together. So we went through this whole bit of one, doing research to understanding current state, doing customer interviews, going through a lot of different sessions and kind of that lean feedback process of idea, hypothesis, testing, and going broad, going narrow, all of those things. But we did it as a team and we made decisions as a team and we really anointed ourselves to have ownership. So instead of the product manager deciding everything, it was engineers owned a piece of it, marketing owned a piece of it, product and design owned a piece of it. And people had a place to have a voice. And being able to pull the team together, it felt like they all equally owned the end experience for the users. It was so transformative at that time. And we'd all been in pods, like little cubicles, right? Mm-hmm. So we literally took our monitors and walked them over to this long desk together and like at the back of the
you
kind of
created
room.
Your own co-working space?
Yeah, we created our own co-working. We just left all the cubicles there, but it was just like vacant in this massive room and they were all on this table in the back. But it was a lot of fun. We had a big TV at the end. We'd sometimes just take breaks and watch cat videos, but funny stuff like that. But it was a great time to be part of this new collaborative environment where agile as a process is one thing, but really getting into the spirit of that methodology and making your own was really exciting into it.
One of the things I hear a lot around agile, is it works as a software development process, but it doesn't always reach out to people beyond the software teams, which maybe you didn't have that at Intuit because you were essentially a software company, but maybe in your later jobs where you, especially now it's at Starling, where you've got not everybody's involved with software, right?
Yeah.
And how do you make Agile work outside of code monkeys?
Definitely. So one thing that I think is interesting is that Agile as a methodology is meant to be malleable. It's meant to being able to figure out and learn about what works best for you, even in terms of not rigidly conforming to the Agile rules for how things are done in terms of Scrum or Kanban or anything like that. So we've made it our own, and we work in continuous delivery in terms of the teams and 2 week sprints and do daily standups. But even from an executive team, we have daily standups together. So Anne and I and the other executives every morning at 10 a.m. we get up and we do standup. And so that's actually a thing. We don't do sprint planning, you know, but we do have our exec meetings. So even taking that to a leadership perspective, or even among marketing teams and other teams that you don't classically see as the development who works in Agile, are really starting to benefit from this kind of new methodology and way of working.
Yeah. So was that new, the executive daily stand-up? Was that a new thing for you to get used to?
Yeah, it was. It's been really good, though, because we have a check-in every day talking around. Like, if there's any kind of big feedback from a customer since we launched, or anything that we really want to discuss as a team, that's time. We always go around and jokingly ask, did anyone break into the bank? And the answer is always no. You know, we don't have any physical location. So it's, but we ask the security question anyway.
Yeah. The alarm didn't go off in the middle of the night.
But yeah, we do that every day, and it's great. It really keeps us in sync together, even though we're all very focused on our individual areas.
But I suppose the reverse of that would be the cybersecurity. That would be the equivalent of breaking into your bank, right?
Yeah, it is. So right now it's a hot topic around security. But what's interesting is when we've seen these advancements in technology, particularly around cloud hosting and the different ways of capturing and storing customer data, what I get really excited about is there's so many advancements that make it even more secure than the previous ways around mainframes and those types of technologies that were previously used by financial institutions. So that is a topic, but definitely it's not someone physically breaking into the bank. It's the more actual likely scenario, if anything were to happen, would be definitely in that area.
Right. So did you ever have a time where you had a really crazy idea and you had to sell it to somebody who was skeptical?
Honestly, I think working on banking as a marketplace is still kind of that crazy idea. So Anne and I immediately just get it. We're like, this is what we're going to work on. This is the future of banking. So to kind of explain what that is, banking as a marketplace means that at Starling, we're focused on the retail current account delivered via mobile. But it's quite complex and time consuming to develop not just a current account, but really innovate in this space, to bring it to a whole new level, to really bring something to market that transforms people's lives in a positive way. But so that means we can't also build out mortgages and savings and pensions and all these other products that we know our customers need. So instead, what we do is we integrate them into something called the marketplace. But this is drastically different. This is crazy from a banker's point of view. No one has done this before. And so everyone is skeptical, and they're like, who owns the customer? How do you do this? What does this mean for revenue? Can you make it happen? So whenever I speak at conferences, it's often seen as this kind of very bold new thing that we're bringing to market. But really, at the end of the day, I was part of a panel earlier, and one of the things Chris Skinner had said was that now there are so many fintechs doing 1,000 different things really well, each focused on a niche. And if the bank tried to replicate those 1,000 things, they just do all of them averagely. You can't do everything. You're just finite. So it's an exciting time to be able to bring this new way of collaboration, this new model of banking forward. But it is crazy, even sometimes to coworkers. So it's something I get excited about pushing forward.
How do you lead people through that, right? Because you're really asking people to do things they've probably not done before in their career. Do they get scared about that? And do you have to do a lot of handholding and reassurance for people?
I think something that I learned into it that has really formed my perspective on this and been helpful is that if you just tell people what we're going to do, what we're going to build, and how we're going to build it, it's very hard to get buy-in. You need to really bring them along for the journey. You need to have conversations and really look at, okay, how did we get to where we are today in terms of like banking as an industry, looking at historically, looking at the 2008 financial crisis, how that limited banks from innovating, but then we saw the iPhone come out the same year as the financial crisis and Uber, WhatsApp, Airbnb, and then how that also had simultaneously the advent and the rise of APIs and how that's changed technology, really kind of thinking through that together and how that transforms what we need to build and offer as a bank, and really having that discussion together and figuring out together how we really manifest that within Starling. Internally, that's how we do it. It's very much a collaborative approach rather than me just saying, we have to do it this way. These are the requirements. And that's how internally we work very collaboratively across different functions.
So you said earlier, you come from a family of lawyers, and that was kind of a baked in expectation for you. Are they refer to you now as she works in computers? Is it that sort of thing?
No, they have no idea what I'm doing. So my grandpa just jokingly tells everyone I work for the CIA. He's like, she's flying everywhere. We have no idea. It's some sort of secret government thing. She calls it product management. You know, it's like, so I think generally they get banks. My grandpa also was a president of a bank. And so they get banking.
But your bank is probably nothing like the bank he worked at, right?
Not at all. And honestly, so at the time, so his primary career is in being in law, being a lawyer and in real estate, but they ended up buying a bank. But at the time, they then told him, as the president of a bank, you actually have to come into the office 3 days a week at least. And he's like, oh, forget that. So he ended up selling the bank quite quickly, but very, very different. Small American bank, not quite the same.
So who inspires you as an entrepreneur?
Who inspires me? I think this is going to be cliche, but the first person that really inspires me as an entrepreneur is Sheryl Sandberg. And that's because of not just
Facebook.
Yeah, Facebook. So because she brings so much to the table in terms of culture, in terms of enabling others, not just from the innovation that they're bringing to market, but enabling people to really kind of anoint themselves into roles and motivate themselves. I think her as a leader and a figure has been very inspirational.
Is there something in particular you try to emulate from her style and your leadership?
I think the most important thing is around believing in others. And I think there's a lot of importance, similar to, I think, some things that Richard Branson said around, you hire smart people and then you let them run with it. Not being that kind of detail telling people how to do what it is, but similar to her around motivating others, enabling others, giving positive feedback, helping people to understand where their strengths are and building on those. I think there's really now this really good mindset of failing is part of the process and that's okay. But at the same time, you shouldn't just focus on kind of getting your weaknesses up to average. You should just focus on your strengths and really capitalizing on those. So that's kind of the inspiration that I've taken from it, is focus on enabling others, really giving that positive feedback, motivating others, and kind of taking that perspective into my own leadership role.
So you believe in a strengths-based leadership approach?
Definitely.
Have you read all of Marcus Buckingham's work around that?
And was he Strengths
Don
Finder?
Clifton. There's a whole long story about that. Yeah. We're originally started for some people that worked at Gallup, Don Clifton and Marcus Buckingham and Don Coffer, but then they've all kind of splintered off into their own versions of that.
Yep.
So Marcus Buckingham was the co-author of the first book was First Break All the Rules. And one of the things they found was that those companies spent way more rather than their weaknesses. And from there, his next book was called Now Discover Your Strengths. Have you read that one?
I think I've read the first one, but I haven't read Now Discover Your Strengths. But when I was first early in my career, I had read that one as well as Multipliers by, and I'm going to forget the author's name, and a few other books. And it tied back into some work being done in positive psychology at the time that I'd studied. But the main thesis that kind of came out of that, as well as from the cognitive research I'd run on, is the mind is like a muscle. And the more you use it, the more you build it. But if you're trying to build a weakness, it's going to be much slower of a process. So if you instead focus on where you already have natural capacity and a natural advantage, strengthening those skill sets is actually much faster. So in order to really, you know, make a difference and try to find your niche, you're going to want to do the thing that you're naturally good at. And that also brings you joy doing, because if you're happy doing it, you're going to be better at doing it and wanting to do it more often.
Well, I've noticed in the last few years, there's been a little bit of a backlash on the strengths-based movement, which in my mind is completely misguided, because they claim that the strengths-based movement tells you to ignore your weaknesses. And I've never read anywhere that it says that. Mm-hmm. What Buckingham does say is you need to improve your weaknesses enough to prevent failure.
Yeah.
But the only path to greatness is to work on your strengths.
Well, it actually, in a funny way, now that I think about it, relates to APIs and marketplaces. Because the whole idea, when you think about that versus strengths as an individual, is you need to do one thing really, really well. Yeah. You need to find your niche. What are you going to uniquely add value on? You can't be everything to everyone. You are finite. You can't be skilled and great at and awesome at everything. It's just not possible. So you need to figure out what it is that you do really well that gets you up in the morning, that you get excited about, and focus on that. It doesn't mean you should ignore your weaknesses. Like if you have a particular weakness that's affecting your day-to-day job, like they say, then of course focus on that, but you don't need to be an expert in all areas to be successful.
Well, like in my career, I knew I was never going to be CFO.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But I had to know a certain amount about the balance sheet and how financial statements worked and so on.
Exactly.
And as I progressed in my career, that bar raised. I had to get a little better, a little better, a little bit, but I was never going to be CFO. Yep.
Or even Elon Musk. So if you look at him and his work at SpaceX and Tesla, he's not necessarily an expert in every part of building a rocket, but he knows enough about it to ask the right questions in the areas that he's not an expert on. And I think that's kind of the point, is you need to have deep areas of expertise, you know, combined with the ability to have enough knowledge to ask the right questions and to be able to have a sufficient level to kind of maintain, but you don't need to be an expert in every single area.
Right. Yeah. So what's your biggest weakness that you know you'll never be world champion at?
I probably would also make a bad CFO. So I'll just go with you on that one. Typically, math was an area that I enjoyed, but I was always just kind of average at. So I think if there was any area, that type of general field or genre, any role that would come from that would probably be my weakness.
On the flip side, what's your superpower?
My superpower. That is a good question. How would I describe my superpower? Making connections between seemingly unrelated things. I don't know. Is that a way to put it?
Sure.
Taking a complex series of information, understanding it and distilling it and creating strategy based upon that. So at Intuit, they had like 5 different skills that you were like rated upon each year. Thinking strategically and driving for results were always my 2 top ones. So I guess if you had to put like the stereotypical name on it, I guess thinking strategically is my skill.
Yeah. So you mentioned also driving for results, and you seem like a very driven person. Were you always that way? Or?
Oh, yeah. So when I was little, I remember wanting to be the first woman president. And I was like, man, Hillary just might beat me to the punch. I'm real worried about it, you know? Thankfully... not thankfully, actually. I'm not going to get into politics, but I guess the job is still potentially open.
Yes, the first women first position is still available.
Yeah. Well, I've decided against that path, but, you know, hypothetically.
So we're not making any announcements for 2020?
No announcements for 2020. Megan Caywood is not, in fact, running for president.
I want to put all those rumors to rest right now. So how do you inspire and lead younger people who are early in their career, and what lessons have you've been able to draw on to kind of help them to contribute to the mission?
Definitely. So the first piece of advice that I give to early career individuals is to not just spend a lot of time thinking about what they should do. A lot of people get caught up with wondering, what path should I take? What should I even apply for? They get stuck very early on in the process of kind of figuring out their career. And what that means is that they end up just spinning for too long. And so instead, my advice is to just dive in. A career path, generally speaking, these days is nonlinear. So once you're in and you're working on something, then things will come together in a series of events that you usually can't predict, and certain introductions and certain meetings will lead to new opportunities. And the whole thing is you just need to get started. Don't spend too much time planning, just get moving. And the other thing is, when you start a job, anoint yourself. Sometimes early on, you get to this place where you're just kind of waiting or expecting for, you know, what
your
manager's...
You're waiting for permission or direction.
Yeah, but instead it's like if you see an opportunity or a problem that you can solve, solve it. And that usually leads to some really positive things. I actually read a funny story, and I forget who the executive was, but basically he said early in his career, he would just join all of like the higher up meetings that he could. He would just slip in. People would ask why he's there. He's like, I'm just taking notes. Don't mind me.
Wait until he gets thrown out.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. And so, but they just were like, okay, he's taking notes, I guess, you know? And then that's how he ended up working his way up to an executive position quite early on. But I think it's doing those kind of bold things with, I want to, you know, solve these problems and do these things, and just kind of being entrepreneurial and driven about making it happen.
What's the boldest thing like that you've ever done?
Oh, gosh. What is the boldest thing? Oh, working on, so Intuit was going to have a UK expansion. It became like their number one priority years ago for their payroll product. And no one was working on it yet, but I knew it was going to be the next thing from some of the reports I'd read on the internet. So I just started researching it. I was reaching out to everyone across the company, figuring out what we knew about the market yet, putting together competitive analyses, starting to reach out to everyone, telling them that I wanted this job. And it was quite bold early on. To want to lead like the number one initiative into our global expansion. But I ended up getting the role. So I worked kind of in the role in a hybrid for a few months before I actually got the role, and convinced them that they should give it to me. So,
well, you acted as if.
Yeah, it worked out quite well.
Right. And you got that. Is anything, when you look back on your career, anything you wish you would have done differently?
No, I think I guess I should say I'm only 28 right now. So to be honest, my career is not long enough yet to say I wish I would have done this differently. I will say that I've gotten very lucky in terms of having the opportunities I've had. In hindsight, I don't think I quite appreciated the value of the network that I would get from the rotational development program at Intuit. It's sort of like when you join a master's program, you get a bit of a network and that's half the value. I think in hindsight, had I been more intentional about seeking that out, it just was lucky that I happened to get it, but I would give that advice to others. And then with meeting Anne as well, in terms of joining an early stage company that's really doing great things, I've gotten lucky, but I'll keep you posted if there's anything I do that I decide I shouldn't have done.
Well, what are you most proud of so far?
Let's see. So the thing that I'm most proud of actually is this year we launched our developer platform at Starling. So everyone's talking about open banking, but currently to date, banks feel like they own customers' data. They don't let them share the data, and it's this huge problem. And so to really be a thought leader in how do you securely and safely build bank APIs that will enable customers to use other financial technology products should they choose to do so. And rather than right now, there's just screen scraping. It's this really insecure and inefficient way of sharing data. It's not good for the customer. And so really being able to bring those open APIs to market and also be a thought leader and set an example to other banks of saying, this is how we can make this successful. This is how we can do it. Was something that I'm proud of because it's not just around what we did at Starling, but it has a wider impact on the UK market that I'm really excited to be able to push forward and be a part of right now.
Great. Well, you mentioned Sheryl Sandberg as a person. I'm wondering, is there a phrase or a saying that you have tacked up above your computer or that you phrase? Is there kind of a go-to thing that's inspiring or emblematic of your philosophy?
If there's anything that's emblematic of my philosophy, it's probably like the Nike phrase of just do it. I don't actually have anything stuck up, but I do recall Anne recently was in an interview and they were asking her like what her favorite quote was from like a woman leader. And the one that she named was that there's a special place in hell for women who don't help each other. I thought that was hilarious. I had never heard that before. So that's another good one that I think is motivational for people to be supportive or women to be supportive and helping.
Oh, that's great.
I think what I've gotten quite lucky with, and that I think is good advice for people to seek out, is mentors. Sometimes if you work with smart people who have already made the mistakes and can help you to understand and avoid those pitfalls. I know at Starling, we've gotten really lucky given Anne's background in banking. So in executive meetings, she's always very good at giving us foresight. She's like, so we're going to launch this, we're going to have to submit this paperwork, we'll probably get this follow-up, these questions will be asked, but really having someone who has a breadth of expertise who can help guide you and get you to a point where you're not sitting here saying like, I made X, Y, and Z mistakes, but it's not because you're so great and you just get it right the first time. It's just you've surrounded yourself with really smart people. And I think that quote of you're the average of the five people you spend the most time with actually holds a lot of weight. So you don't have to be the smartest or the best. You just need to also surround yourself. Grit is more important really at the end of the day, probably, than intelligence. So people are also willing to stick with problems and can, you know, really help push the envelope on things is important advice.
So have you found yourself assessing and maybe reconfiguring those five people you spend most of your time with?
Oh, I always do. You can't keep the same five people, right? Well, moving from San Francisco to London kind of forced that, I would say.
Right.
But I got lucky enough before I met Anne, I was still on the track of starting my own company. So I joined an accelerator, like a FemTech specific accelerator in London. And had the opportunity to meet some amazing women CEOs. So Emma Margetts of like Alpha Exchange and some others, but who are like the five people. So now Anne is definitely one of them as well. But I definitely think you need to kind of evolve that as you move on to different stages in your life and keep that updated, I suppose you should say.
That's great.
Yeah.
So besides growing Starling, any other big ambitions you want to tackle in the coming decade?
Oh, goodness. So I see myself as a lifer at Starling. It's great. So we spent about the last year building our platform, which was a bold move because you saw some other first movers coming to market.
Right.
Like Monzo and others who just focused on the front end but had a prepaid card built on like Wirecard.
Right.
We took the other perspective. We're really going to build the bank from scratch. So we've done that, but now we've actually...
In many ways, it was the opposite of a lean startup, right?
Yeah.
You spent a lot of time on some really, you know, hard stuff.
It's actually an important point that you bring out because lots of people ask, like, how do you actually innovate when it takes so long to get to market? Because to build a bank and to get a banking license, you can't just launch an MVP. It's not the same. So we worked in continuous delivery, doing several releases a day, but we made sure to constantly be testing ourselves. And then as soon as we got the banking license with restrictions, to open that up to a wider set of people in terms of friends and family and start really getting that feedback early, because you need to be getting feedback continuously. You can't wait a year to launch to the public and surprise everyone. It just doesn't work that way. So, but now that we were able to kind of weave that into the process, even with the regulator in terms of getting feedback early on, well now, so we just launched Spending Insights. We have all of the things that you'd expect from a current account in terms of an overdraft and interest rate and the additional features like card control. And now this developer platform with our APIs that we're super proud of. But then it's now a lot faster for us to develop these other differentiating features. So like the Starling Marketplace, where now we're bringing in all of these other providers from across the ecosystem into Starling, something new that we're able to launch at a faster velocity. And then today we just announced that we're passporting into Ireland. So that means that our expansion into Europe is the next thing that we're focusing on over the next couple of years. So being able to do all of that really quickly and then, you know, move even further out in terms of global expansion is really exciting for us and something that's been enabled because we focused on building the current account rather than getting distracted with some other options to just innovate on the front end or the user experience first. So it's been a good journey.
No, that's very exciting.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, Megan, thanks for being here.
Yeah, thank you so much. I've enjoyed it, JP.
Great. I'm JP Nichols. This has been the Serial Entrepreneur Podcast. If you like the show, please give it a 5-star rating. That really helps other people discover it. You can also learn more and support this and all the other great podcasts from Provoke Media at provoke.fm.